This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia trumpet writers Jeremiah Jacques, Mihailo Zekic, Richard Palmer, and Andrew Miller. We're bringing you the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour here on June 7th, 2024. Yesterday being June 6th, the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We do hope to have a little bit of a discussion on that later if we've got time. But first, we're going to start with our four regions of the world and an update on the news in each region this week. We're going to start with Anglo-America. So Andrew Miller, give us an update on your region, Anglo-America.
As usual, there's a lot happening in the Anglo-American region this week. In the United Kingdom, at least four National Health Services hospitals in London were hit by cyber attacks. Meanwhile, pro-abortion activists in the United States continue to vandalize churches across the nation. And a prominent Wall Street analyst is pointing out that there has actually been no increase in jobs for native-born U.S. workers in 5 years, meaning all new jobs have gone to immigrants, legal or otherwise.
It's interesting that somebody could go through and parse that data in that way. And I had heard some things about the jobs being, you know, not good jobs or part-time jobs or people having to work multiple jobs because of the bad economy and the so-called strength of the job market being not a strength at all. But this is a really interesting angle that most of the new jobs have gone to immigrants.
No, that is actually a pretty interesting breakdown of the data. Just looking at, I mean, the Biden administration keeps talking about, like, we've created this many new jobs and we've created this many new jobs. And indeed, there has been some new job creation, but it's not even fast enough to keep up with the number of immigrants coming right into the country. So it's you're creating new ones because you have all these, like, more than 2 million people are arriving each year. So if you're not creating at least 2 million jobs each year, you're losing ground. And most of the analysts I've read believe that there'll be another 2 million people or more this year, because despite the hopes of many, the immigration crisis, it's already the worst in American history, and it's about to get worse. We focus quite a bit on this program on the role Biden's played in facilitating this open border, but it takes two to tango, and the border crisis is largely the result of policies, the intersection of policies between the U.S. government and the Mexican government. And the Mexican government is just as guilty as the Biden government for allowing this situation to continue. They actually just had an election in Mexico this week, elected Mexico's first woman president, I think might be even first Jewish president, Claudia Sheinbaum. And she got 60% of the vote, so almost a supermajority. Actually, she's from the same Morena party as the current president, López Manuel Obrador, Andre López Manuel Obrador, who only got 55% of the vote last election. So his party, she's his hand-picked successor. She didn't take the presidency from him. He endorsed her. She's coming in as his successor. Same political party, even more popular than it was last time around, which means that there's not necessarily going to be a major shift in Mexican policy, but the same Mexican policies we've had for the last 6 years are going to continue. I actually wrote an article, well, time flies by, but it's about 6 years ago.
Yeah, 2018, right.
Titled Mexico's New Revolution, just pointing out that actually Mexico had been a one-party state for about 7 decades. And then all of a sudden, in the course of just a few years, this new party rose up and is now getting 60% of the vote. Radically far left, López Manuel Obrador or his successor aren't necessarily card-carrying communists themselves, although some of the people in their administration are. And they've come in here mainly supported by the poorer classes in Mexico, kind of like rising up against the aristocracy, trying to really push a new vision on that country. In particular, with drug cartels, López Manuel Obrador, he's had the famous phrase, hogs, not bullets. which doesn't sound assuring for people who boil you in acid if you cross them. But he made the case, and his new president supports it, that like back around 2000, the Mexican government basically declared war on the cartels. And so the murder rate in Mexico spiked, because that's what happens when you fight a war. And so he's like, well, he's like, in order to bring the murder rate down, he's like, we need hugs, not bullets. So it's like, so we're going to try to like reach accommodations, which actually has worked. The murder rate has come down. He accomplished his objective. It's like you less people die when you don't fight your enemy. But the cartels are stronger than ever and have shifted into human trafficking. So a lot of what you're seeing on the southern border here is the result of this new political party, the Morena political party. They're not fighting the cartels. They're giving them hugs. And while they continue to traffic fentanyl, traffic human beings, traffic children, traffic sex slaves, traffic weapons, counterfeit money. With 2 million people crossing the border each year, I think the coyotes charge about $1,000 per person to traffic a Guatemalan into the United States. So you multiply 1,000 by however many million are coming here. And I mean, this is a source of revenue for them equal or greater to the drug trade. And so we've seen the results of this. We've had 6 years to go back and see the results. Like, well, what's this new hugs, not bullets policy going to work? And we've now got the biggest border crisis in American history. Like I said, you can't peg all the blame on that on the Morena Party, because it just so happens that while Morena's using this new hugs, not bullets policy, the Biden administration has passed an executive order day one. Don't build a border wall. Don't send people back. Give them asylum while we process them. So you've actually got the Democratic Party in the United States and the Morena Party in Mexico really working together to create what's the biggest migrant crisis in United States history. Things got bad under Reagan for a while in 86, and they got better. Then they got bad under George Bush for a while in 2000. Then they got better. And now they're way worse than they were under Reagan or Bush.
I think when the history books are written and people look back on this period, they will be shocked and ashamed that we allowed this to happen. And I remember before 2016, this not even being a central issue that people would talk very much about. And it is to Donald Trump's credit that he made this a big issue, because it's a huge issue. It's a humanitarian crisis. When we're talking about millions of people crossing the border like that, we are talking about thousands of rapes and deaths to exposure and starvation and abuse of these criminals against the people they're trafficking. People are suffering. Where the American policy is encouraging it, and it's dishonorable in the extreme what we have allowed as the American people to happen and to continue. And at best, what we have, like, strongly worded rhetoric, and nothing changes. This is an absolute crisis, and it's hard to understand how we have let this continue and let people continue to suffer down there, be they the people being trafficked or the Border Patrol or the people whose ranches and farms and communities are being, you know, overrun. It's shocking. To me, it's just a...
Did you mention how many local government officials got killed in the election campaign? I think it was it more than 30? Andrew might know the figure, but I mean, it's like in some parts of Mexico, the cartels are kind of becoming the government. They're running the place to the point that they're killing political candidates that aren't going along with them. I mean, it's starting to look more like almost a foreign government or terrorist group taking over territory than what we would typically think of as a drug gang.
Right.
Yeah, our own Senator James Lankford from here in Oklahoma has pointed out before that, like, when you look at it on a county-by-county basis in Mexico, or if county is what they call it, the drug cartels own about 40% of Mexico. It means that, like, the government and the cartel, sometimes there's collusion, sometimes there's fighting, but they said in about 40% of Mexico, the cartels are more powerful than the government. basically all the Sonora provinces, all the parts around the border. It's like the drug cartels are actually more of a force to be reckoned with than the Mexican government. Now, if you get down close to Mexico City, there's still drug cartels there, but the government kind of holds the balance of power. I didn't look up the exact figures this election, but that is very much quid pro quo in Mexico, that if you're a local politician who's running on an anti-drug cartel campaign, you will probably die. So I know it's at least dozens, could be hundreds. They use a carrot and a stick approach where you're offered bribe money. A lot of Mexican politicians just take the bribe money. If you reject the bribe money, then it's like you get axed off.
And so much of this because so many of us demand drugs. If we stopped taking drugs tomorrow, we Americans, we would absolutely crush the cartels. But as it is, we have cartels with state-like power that we and our corrupt regime have empowered.
Yeah, this is definitely a huge geopolitical catastrophe for the United States. Peter Zeehan, he wrote back in 2008, this was back when he worked for Stratford, that he said, even if every country in South America were run by anti-American governments, it wouldn't overly concern Washington, as these states alone or en masse lack the ability to threaten America's interest in all ways but one. He said the drug trade undermines American society from within, generates massive cost for social stability, law enforcement, and health systems and trade. So he said this is basically one way that there's no nation really on earth at this point wants to like overtly challenge the United States militarily. But there are nations, China being one of them, that are interested in stirring up chaos at the border, because since it's a crime operation, not an official military invasion, it's kind of like a proxy war, that you're just weakening the social fabric of America from within. There's a prophecy in Isaiah 5 and verse 5 where God actually, he likens end time America to a vineyard with a hedge around it, and then says that he'll take away the hedge. This is a prophecy that the Plain Truth under Herbert W. Armstrong highlighted, and we've highlighted many times as well, saying that if you look at the North American continent, that's a very apt analogy. Otto von Bismarck said that America is the most fortunate of nations because it's surrounded on the north and south by friendly nations, and on the east and west by fish. So between the two world's two biggest oceans, America is pretty well protected. It's kind of its one weak spot is the Rio Grande River with Mexico. And that is where all these drug cartels and hostile criminals and other people are pouring into. The Plain Truth actually identified the Cuban Revolution as kind of like the first hole in America's hedge, where you've got now Cuban immigrants coming in there. It's like that's the first way for the wild animals to go through the hedge into the vineyard. But this border crisis under Biden in Mexico is pretty much it's not just a hole in the hedge. You've blown down an entire wall of the hedge. The East Coast, the West Coast, and the Canadian border, for the most part, are still intact. But that fourth wall of the hedge is non-existent, and you're just being flooded with a lot of hostile groups that are just tearing apart America from within.
And it's interesting that scripture is written. God is writing that in response to the individual behavior of the people within the hedge. But that article you mentioned was Mexico's New Revolution. And I should also mention, Jeremiah, your article on China's role in trafficking fentanyl. What was the title of that?
Yeah, that was called Murder with a Borrowed Knife. To me, it was very stunning to research through that and to realize, I mean, I think most people know that the precursor chemicals that make fentanyl come from China, despite U.S. efforts to stop that. But what most people don't realize is that is only the start. China is actively involved in every step of the process that brings this deadly scourge into America. Every phase of the fentanyl crisis is really being orchestrated from Beijing, and it's just shocking to see their fingerprints over every aspect of it.
And again, the way to fight it, Trumpet Hour listener, is to say, not in my home. That's the grassroots, if you will, response that you have to have, that each of us has to have, to get the message of what's happening. Like, we are in a crisis. Why is it happening? And what can you do about it? In this case, the answer to that is clear. Now let's move across the North Atlantic to Europe. Richard Palmer, you've been watching the Europe region. Can you give us an update on your region?
Yes, European Parliament elections are happening right now. They take place in various different countries between Thursday going through to Sunday. European Parliament was set up to give the EU the illusion of democracy. It doesn't have a huge amount of real power beyond kind of slowing down initiatives or throwing its toys out of the pram. So this doesn't matter massively in terms of its actual repercussions, but it's an excellent barometer for Europe-wide political trends, seeing as you have all of Europe voting in similar elections at the same time. I'm sure we'll talk about that more next week when we've got the actual results. But I think that one of the big things that people have talked about in the run-up is the young shifting towards the far right. Last election, about 5 years ago, you had a big surge from young voters towards green parties and far left groups. Now the 18 to 24 vote has kind of swung in the other direction and is voting for these kind of fringe right groups in surprisingly large numbers. So it'll be a good measure of dissatisfaction in European politics, and I think there'll be a lot there that we can talk about. Here in the UK, we've also got an election campaign underway with the vote happening on July 4th, and we had a pretty big shakeup in that this week as Nigel Farage, this kind of big figure from Brexit and the Brexit referendum, announced that he would be standing for Parliament. Initially, he'd said he was going to sit it out. He hadn't had time to put a run together, he said, but because of his busy kind of TV career and things like that. But nope, he chucked all of that out on the windows on Monday, said, I'm changed my mind. I'm going to lead the Reform Party for the next 5 years. I'm standing for Parliament. So quite a dramatic entry into the race, and it has really shaken things up with that Reform Party almost neck and neck with the Conservative Party. You know, it would take an absolute miracle for him to win the election, given that Reform have no MPs right now. But he is poised to play a bigger role in British politics after the election. And given that he is pretty close to Donald Trump, and we know that trends in Britain and America are going to be aligned to a certain extent, I think that's something very interesting to watch. We also had big floods in Germany this week with thousands evacuated. I mean, this is an important, the weather stories are important to keep watching. What was it? Several thousand died in Papua New Guinea the other week as they had mudslides. There's been tornadoes in the United States. I mean, this is a way that God continues to get the attention of the whole world.
All important stories, but you've got one you want to dwell on here. What's your main story?
So we've talked about migrants and migrant attacks for a while now. This is one that has really cut through, and a migrant attack that has grabbed the attention of a lot of people across Europe, probably perhaps because the whole attack was caught on video. So you had a kind of anti-Islam protest. If you look at the videos, it's a very small protest. There's not really many people there. And then this Muslim immigrant comes out and stabs the main speaker. Michael Sturzenberg is his name. A policeman runs towards his defense. This Muslim man stabs the police officer. The police officer later dies of his wounds. In all, I think 5 or 6 people were killed before this attacker was shot, not killed, and then subdued. And then you had another, same town, let's see, this was in Mannheim. Same town, you had an Alternative for Deutschland politician attacked on Tuesday. Again, I think this was somebody from Afghanistan that did the attacking. And all of this is happening in the context of that European election that I mentioned. And it has, again, led to this upswing in people waking up to speaking out about this problem from Germany. And it's the same dynamics that we've seen again and again and again, where it's alerting people that there are real problems here and the authorities are sticking their fingers in their ears and trying to, going la, 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 ignoring the whole thing. So, for example, they had a funeral or a public memorial service for this slain soldier this week, and a Muslim imam was speaking there to give a prayer. They're trying to do everything they can to push this message of it's not about Islam or it's about one crazy guy and what he believes or his religion and what sacred book he reads. That's all irrelevant. And even this guy organizing the protest, Michael Sturzenberger, you know, he's been kind of prosecuted for hate speech. He's been prosecuted for hate speech, for example, showing a Nazi shaking hands with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, which is a real picture.
Right.
that happened.
Don't
there
share
was
that
a
fact.
Relation. Yeah, right. It so you know, he's speaking out against Islam. He's not telling lies about Islam, at least based on what I've seen. I'm not an expert on his background. Maybe there is more, but you look at what he's been prosecuted for, and it's for telling the truth. And so it's, again, this real problem. Leadership just aren't paying attention. And of course, as you all know, you know, if there's a problem you don't want to face, sticking your fingers in your ears and ignoring it never solves that problem. You know, that's just going to guarantee things are going to blow up in your face further down the line when you're forced to confront this. And that's what we're seeing, I think, in Europe and Germany.
Right. On the one hand, it's one attack, you know, one, I guess, batch of victims, not just one victim, but, you know, a handful of victims. And then the second attack that you mentioned there. On the other hand, we have got to watch this like a hawk, because the political violence and the strain among people and the frustration and the anger always has the potential to become violence. And so when we see these scattered examples, if you will, they could very quickly escalate and retaliation can occur, and the whole political situation in Europe can change pretty dramatically as the violence moves from rhetoric and policy to knives and firearms.
And I think that, if I may, it ties in with what you mentioned in the rundown of the top stories too, with the timing and all of this, with people voting on, like, for European parliamentary elections. One of the big things everyone's afraid of is how well the far right are going to do. When you're literally going to the ballot box and you see an Afghan stab a police officer and then an imam is speaking at his funeral, what are you going to put on that ballot, especially in Germany, which we've talked about quite a lot on this? All these problems seem to be sinking together so much to create a perfect storm where you're going to see the far right. We've talked about them being normalized. In this case, they're going to be embraced.
And I think that's absolutely right. And then I think what interests me a lot is the cultural shift as well as the political shift. In some ways, that's the, what's the saying? Politics is downstream from culture or something. Like, it's the cultural shift that drives a lot of that.
Right.
And I don't know whether you or our listeners, you might have heard this Ausländer's Raus.
Right.
Song, this kind of electronic dance anthem that has been reworded. Basically, the words in German is Germany for the Germans, foreigners out. And you know, you're seeing stories of, say, someone, a migrant, they'll get on a bus and everyone on the bus will start singing this song. Like, it's becoming more and more and more common. And what you're seeing is, you know, you've got this Alternative for Deutschland party that genuinely has neo-Nazis and genuinely has some very disturbing people that want to rewrite history. And you read what they put out and it is absurd. It is like Germany is a victim in World War II, and they've been not allowed to talk about their victimhood, that American troops committed atrocities against Germans at the end of World War II, and Eisenhower put Germans in death camps, and like it is a glorification of the Nazis and a complete revision of German history. But you have people looking on and saying, you know, Germans need to stand up to these Syrian migrants. They need to stand up to people that are stabbing them in the streets. What they need to do is be more patriotic. They need to revive this. And they're endorsing openly the Alternative for Deutschland and saying, you know, these guys are the solution. And I think they're not taking the time to look at what they're actually saying. But you're seeing a complete change in German culture now, where then it's becoming acceptable to maybe violence or at least aggression against foreigners, you know, these kind of dark elements from German history, they're now becoming acceptable. And you're having that drive this kind of cultural change.
And where do you see this cultural change ending up?
Well, this is the big change that we've been forecasting for Germany. Well, Herbert W. Armstrong was forecasting since 1945, and that you would have this revival of the Nazi spirit within Germany. And where you have people rightly worried about the future of their country, and they see the only people talking about it are these far-right extremists, they're starting to embrace some of these far-right extremists and some of these positions that were once very rare becoming more and more normal. And I think there's more people waking up as they're seeing, say, some of, you know, they're seeing crowds of Germans across Germany singing Foreigners out. It doesn't take too many dots to kind of connect that to the rise of this Nazi spirit. So I think others are waking up to that too. But that's what the Bible prophesies, in that you've got this empire in Europe that rises and falls. You know, there's a direct real connection between each rise and fall of this empire. And what you're seeing rising in Europe now is a successor to what was there in Europe in 1945, which was a successor to some of these empires, Catholic empires in Europe, and the Holy Roman Empire in the Middle Ages, and Charlemagne. And you know, Revelation 17 describes a beast, an empire, and biblical symbolism that rises and falls. And it's rising now in Germany. And some of these people that are trying to ignore problems with migrants, some of them may be well-meaning, but they're helping that empire rise more quickly. And that's something that Mr. Brad McDonald and I talked about in a Trumpet Print article back last time you had the Syrian crisis, and that's called Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie.
That's Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie. And that Nazi period of German history seems like a one-off, an anomaly. It's got its own look to it. It's got its own, you know, wild facts, just unbelievable history. And you think, you know, that can't happen again. But like you just said, the spirit that came roaring out in such a horrific way in the Nazi regime was not unique to that regime. It preceded it. It came surging out of it. It was put back down, but it's still there, that underlying spirit. And the Germany of the future will not be an exact carbon copy of that. It'll be more sophisticated, more modern. But again, the Nazis were sophisticated and modern in their time. But there is an underlying reason why Germany exploded into violence that way, why we had so many of our men having to die there on the beaches of Normandy at the hands of German troops. That there's an underlying spirit there, and it takes some real depth and some knowledge and some reliance on the Bible, as you say there, to understand how that there's a underlying spirit that continues to exist through all of these eras and what it is that motivates it. But to get started on that, you can look at Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie. You're listening to the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Hello and welcome back to Trumpet Hour. Thanks for staying with us. We've covered the Anglo-America region. We've covered the Europe region. Now we're going to move over to Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, what's the news from Asia this week?
First, quite a disturbing update about Russia's war on Ukraine. There was an exchange this week of prisoners of war. So Ukraine released some Russian soldiers that it had captured in exchange for Russia releasing some Ukrainian soldiers. And the Ukrainians who were released, many of them had been POWs for almost 2 years, and these people look like Holocaust victims. The footage of them is astonishing, with many of them weighing, it looks like, less than half of what they should, and bearing all kinds of signs of torture as well. And of course, these are the ones who survived. You know, their testimony shows that great numbers of POWs did not survive the starvation and torture of Russian captivity. There's also a lot of evidence that's just come out of systematic use of rape by the Russians against the captives. That's a longstanding favorite method of the Russians, whether the captive is male or female. And most of the details about this are too disturbing to discuss, but it does call to mind this statement from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury. He wrote this in the Trumpet about a year ago. It says, "Russia's war on Ukraine is giving the world a vivid picture of the scale of evil Putin is willing to commit. Putin is an evil, ruthless, vindictive agent with Soviet-style methods of psychological warfare, assassination, and war. He has disgusting, even devastating policies that are sick to the core and even satanic. End quote. So, you know, that was Mr. Gerald Fleury's take on Putin and the way he and his men are prosecuting this war. And this week we got some disturbing evidence showing just how accurate that assessment is. Another quick story here about India's election. This just ended on Tuesday after about 6 weeks of voting, and it was the largest democratic exercise in human history. India now has the world's most populous country. It passed China up about a year ago. And so some 640 million people voted in this election, which is just a stunning figure. That's almost two times the total U.S. population who cast a vote. And the results of this gave a rare third term to Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Modi is a Hindu nationalist, and he is notably, he has steered India closer to Vladimir Putin's Russia during his time at the helm. So with Modi's re-election victory, we can expect that to continue, and we can expect Modi's India to increasingly support and back Putin's Russia, no matter how wicked Putin's Russia is.
And back to Putin's Russia and its wickedness, I think it's really important that you bring that quote to us, that Mr. Fleury quote, reminding us of who it is that's at the head of this whole war machine. And it's not just a war machine. I think we in the West think of war in a certain way, but it's still ugly and savage in all the ways that you were describing and not describing, and as far as what's happening to those prisoners of war that the Russians have taken and held. Your main story has to do with Vladimir Putin and Russia practicing war closer to home.
That's right. Yes, the big story is Russians in the Caribbean. Russia is currently deploying warships and combat aircraft to the Caribbean, where they'll be conducting major military exercises. Right now, there are three Russian warships heading across the Atlantic on their way there. They're led by the Admiral Gorshkov missile frigate. And then there's also a nuclear-powered, nuclear-capable submarine in this fleet. The war games are expected to begin next week, probably on the 12th. And this will be the first time in 5 years that the Russians have staged these kinds of games in the Western Hemisphere that involve both air and sea operations. And then it's also notable that as part of these exercises, the Russians are expected to make port calls in Cuba and Venezuela. Those are both longstanding Russian partners. So it comes as no surprise, really, to see Russia making port calls in those nations. But these war games and port calls as well, they're significant because they're happening in a region that the United States depends on heavily for shipping and even for our security. In recent years, we've seen both Russia and China deepening their influence around these shipping lanes, especially by building stronger ties with Cuba, with Nicaragua, with Venezuela. And this is something that Geopolitical Futures founder George Friedman has warned about, just because of the threat that it poses to America's economy and America's security. He wrote, quote, "The choke points for some of America's most important shipping lanes are the waters between Cuba and the Yucatan Peninsula and between Cuba and Florida. The port of New Orleans and the port of Houston depend on these two outlets to ship and receive critical commodities for the U.S. From Cuba, a long-term threat could be maintained." End quote. So just a very sobering assessment there from George Friedman, especially when you consider how much America depends on those shipping lanes. And also when you consider that the U.S. does have serious vulnerability in this area.
I just checked, and it turns out that right now in the Caribbean, the only thing the U.S. Navy has there are autonomous sail drones. But the east coast of the United States is just bristling with air bases and naval bases, and the U.S. could surge ships and aircraft out if in this exercise and somehow in some way turned threatening.
That was analyst David Martin there, just explaining that America really doesn't have notable military assets in the Caribbean. You know, he does stress that we could mobilize our east force our East Coast forces in the event of a conflict there. But it is somewhat concerning, I think, that in this region itself, which America depends on so much, the U.S. Navy has very little there. And meanwhile, Russia and China are deepening their influence there very quickly.
I think probably one of the reasons we don't have a fleet there is because it's understood you had better not.
Yeah.
You would better not dare. And yet Vladimir Putin is daring to send that message that we are aggressive enough, we are capable enough. This is actually the largest nuclear power in the world. They apparently have even more nuclear warheads than the United States does.
Yes.
And they're coming right into the Gulf of Mexico, which if you haven't thought about shipping lanes in the Gulf of Mexico, you have that luxury because of the shipping lanes in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
Because the entire waterways of the United States, as if crafted by a creator god, equate to highways that go directly down to the Port of New Orleans, as well as the Port of Houston. They are the reason this nation is a superpower, you know, agriculturally and manufacturing. Everything just benefits richly from this maritime highway system that goes all around the center of the United States. All of the arable farmland can basically drain its goods into ships down there in the Gulf of Mexico and ship and receive. Look around in the things in your room. Probably a bunch of those things came through the Port of Houston, through the Port of New Orleans. And if that is attacked, if that is threatened, then the whole thing changes. The whole equation changes. A blockade, an actual blockade. Obviously, we would mobilize forces in the event of an actual blockade, but that's a clear threat being made by Vladimir Putin and a pretty good indicator of how bold Russia's resurgence under him is getting.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment for sure. And this takes on a lot of significance in light of prophecies in Isaiah 23 and also Ezekiel 27. These talk about a mart of nations or an economic alliance that Russia and China will build with European nations. And when you put those passages alongside Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, it's clear that this economic alliance will be built mostly in order to besiege the United States and to block it out of world trade. That passage in Deuteronomy 28, it says America will be, quote, besieged in its gates. And we have an article on thetrumpet.com. It's called Storming America's Castle. It takes a close look at these different passages, and it shows just how serious the threat that America is facing is. And I just think when we see Russia holding these kinds of war games in the Caribbean and doing port calls in Cuba and Venezuela, and when we see China, of course, also deepening its influence there, we can really see that it is creating the conditions for that prophesied besiegement to take place.
A mart of nations and a besiegement. The Bible talking about a mart of nations. This means waterways, railways, air corridors, highways, exchanging of goods, empowering all the nations that are involved in that mart of nations, and besieging and blocking the railways, the air corridors, the highways, the waterways of the enemy, which is principally the United States. And that, you're saying, is in the Bible, and it applies to the modern United States. Have a look, preparing to storm America's castle there at thetrumpet.com, and see for yourself whether those prophecies that have been written a long time ago, preserved for a long time, whether or not they were written and preserved for this time today. Start with preparing to storm America's castle there at thetrumpet.com. All right, on to our final region, the Middle East. Mihailo Zekic, what news from the Middle East?
Carrying on from what we talked about last week, that censure that the International Atomic Energy Agency was supposed to look at was passed on Wednesday. The European powers, Britain, France, and afterwards we found out Germany, went ahead with this. And perhaps surprisingly, so did the United States. Probably all the pressure and sidelining that Europe gave the current presidency took the government a bit aback, and so they decided to save face and not look too bad in front of their allies. The censure is basically meaningless, saying that Iran must comply with what the instructions of the previous censure in 2022 said, which said basically more or less suggestions. So it's a bit meaningless, but a big demonstration on the U.S. and its allies on the relations between them and how they're dealing with Iran. Speaking about Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, remember him? He is running for the Iranian presidency. Since the former president, Ebrahim Raisi, was assassinated, they're having early elections. Ahmadinejad, the former firebrand mayor of Tehran, is running again. He was president, I don't remember exactly when he left office, but it must be close to 15 years now. He was pretty famous for being probably the most vocal person calling for Israel's destruction. He's also not a cleric, and since he's left office, he's fallen afoul with the supreme leader and the clerical establishment there, which is why he's tried running before, and they've always vetoed him. But with the unique circumstances surrounding Iran and the Middle East in general, who knows, maybe the Ayatollah might have a change of heart. But we'll see about that. And then finally, Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz is issuing an ultimatum that if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't clear out some stuff, like what the day after plan for Gaza is and that kind of thing, he'll leave the government by tomorrow night. Anything could happen by the time this episode airs. He might stand down. He might actually leave. What exactly that means for the Israeli government is yet to be seen, but that'll probably be something we'll be talking about this time next week.
So some divisions there at the very top of the Israeli government, and that IAEA story being another example of the United States being in this bizarre position. I've never accepted that it's not bizarre that the United States is in this position of coming to and trying to assist Iran, at least behind the scenes in the case of that IAEA story. But for your main story, not quite so much behind the scenes.
Yes, I won't introduce it. I'll let Joe Biden do it.
The first phase would last for 6 weeks. Here's what it would include: a full and complete ceasefire, a withdrawal of Israeli forces from all populated areas of Gaza. The people of Israel should know they can make this offer without any further risk to their own security because they've devastated Hamas forces over the past 8 months. At this point, Hamas no longer is capable carrying out another October 7th.
That was a speech he gave last week, but after we already got this episode up and running, so I thought I'd cover it now. Basically calling for an Israeli ceasefire in Gaza. He claims that the Israelis were the ones to approach him with that. Barack Obama tweeted his support, quote, "Today, President Biden put forward a clear, realistic, and just plan to establish an immediate ceasefire and end the war in Gaza," end quote, on X, formerly known as Twitter. So even he's saying it was Biden's idea. And if it was Israel's idea, I think it's pretty curious that Israel rejected their own plan. And so did Hamas. So on the ground, on the surface, nothing's going to happen about that. There was just a few details there. But it certainly shows what the Biden administration, really the shadow Obama administration, is trying to do. Those particular clips I played there basically form the crux of it. Israel withdraws and Hamas stays in power in some form or another. This is similar to some other ideas people have floated around where, like, say, the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas and all their people come into Gaza and they make a deal with Hamas. This is the crux about basically every serious supposedly ceasefire proposal that comes from the U.S. or some of these other international groups. You need to let Hamas be. There needs to be worked out somewhere. Their future is still on the ground. As I mentioned, Barack Obama tweeted his response to this, and it's a fairly lengthy response. If you go onto his Twitter page, Mr. Palmer covered this on our sister program, The Trumpet Daily, earlier this week as well. You could see his fingerprints all over this. It's pretty similar to what he's been trying to do when he was officially president, and the fact that he's taking a break from his retirement, wishing Happy Mother's Day and a lot of other fluff on his Twitter page to comment about this suggests that there's a lot more going on here. Continuing with Biden, he gave an interview with Time magazine where they asked him if he thinks Netanyahu is prolonging the war just for his own political survival. Biden says he's not going to comment about it, and then he says immediately after that this, quote, "There is every reason for people to draw that conclusion," end quote. So for him to say that about somebody that's supposedly an ally, like, it doesn't matter who it is, unless if it's somebody really, really nasty like Kim Jong-un. Normally, these kinds of statements are not made by the leader of the free world. You can see the whole deep state apparatus is getting really, really desperate. Like, Israel is slowly but surely making its way into Rafah, and the more they do that, the more they start panicking. The more they start throwing out these desperate ceasefire plans, the more they start saying these kinds of things to make Netanyahu look bad. They sound scared, in my opinion, scared that Rafah is going to be over and done with, and there's going to be no more leverage over Israel to let Hamas be. On a similar vein, related story, but with arguably even bigger implications, yesterday Axios reported that the U.S. government is pressuring Israel to not have what they call a limited war in Lebanon against the Hezbollah, the much more armed terror group up there. Now, war with Hezbollah is a pretty scary scenario that a lot of Israelis don't want to see, but they're still lobbing explosives into Israeli territory. There's still thousands of people evacuated from there. Netanyahu's made ultimatums before about if this keeps up, something's going to happen. The fact that the U.S. government is apparently pushing at Israel not to do this suggests that it is very, very much on the table and perhaps even likely. If that happens, the commentary that I'll be giving on the show will take a much more dramatic turn, and I don't want to dwell too much on what ifs. But the fact that Israel is progressing with this war and that you're seeing the U.S. make these kind of bolder pushes against Israel shows that they're dropping their pretense a little bit about what their aims are with the war, what they want Israel to get out of it, and they're trying as much as possible to put their foot down.
And when you talk about the United States and its intervention, you mentioned, you know, a tweet by Barack Obama. A lot of people have been posting a lot of things about this war, and a lot of people are trying to influence it in various ways. This program always zeroes in on anything stated by Barack Obama. Why is that? Why is his post and his thought on the matter so relevant?
We'll take it from two angles. From the purely physical perspective, Barack Obama's whole vision on the Middle East since he got into office in 2009 was to empower Iran and radical Islamic forces and to marginalize Israel. In this case, they intersect because all these terror groups are Iranian proxies. Benjamin Netanyahu, in his autobiography, says on his very first meeting with Obama, he talked about Iran and the Palestinians, and Obama sounded pretty good about Iran. That obviously was a lie. But as soon as he mentioned the Palestinians, that's when Obama showed his real vicious side, and that Israel needs to withdraw completely overnight and create a two-state solution. And in his famous Cairo speech, he said he was going to not stop working until that happens. We talk on this program a lot in the Angle America section about how a lot of the things going on with the country, especially with the cognitive decline of Joe Biden, ultimately traced back to Obama. It's not just America that has this problem. So is foreign policy, and in this case, especially with Israel and its relationship with the Palestinians. I mean, the whole war itself started because of all the money that Obama has been giving Iran and its proxies through sanctions relief, through protecting certain Palestinian figures. He has his fingerprints all over this, and he's starting to come out more and more out of the shadows, both personally and through his avatars, in a sense. But also spiritually, we focus on, well, a few prophecies. One in 2 Kings chapter 14 that talks about Israel, not just the state of Israel, but also including America and Britain facing a crisis so big that their name is almost blotted out under heaven. Bitter affliction, it's called. Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has tied that in with a prophecy in Daniel 8 of a little horn representing a very powerful king that has Satan behind him, causing damage to the people of God. And for those prophecies, Mr. Fleury has pointed to Barack Hussein Obama as being the fulfillment of them, not just in 2009, but all the way to now. He is the kernel of instigation of everything that's going on in America, in Israel, all this chaos we're seeing all over the place. And we're seeing him step out more and more out of the shadows, even after his presidency has technically been over for years for us to see. If our listeners would like to learn more about this, this is just a brief summary, but why we tie Obama with these prophecies and the proof and what it means for us today, Mr. Fleury has written a flagship book, America Under Attack, that explains all of that and much more.
That's America Under Attack. You can find that at AmericaUnderAttack.com. We also have Obama's Radical Transformation of the Middle East, which is a Trumpet Daily program there at thetrumpet.com, and will be written up for Monday's Trumpet Brief. So if you haven't subscribed to the Trumpet Brief, go to thetrumpet.com and make sure you subscribe and get that email. And you can even get it customized to your preference. That's the Trumpet Brief email newsletter at thetrumpet.com. And that will explain really kind of the only possible solution, if you really think about it, as to why a nation founded by men like George Washington and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson that sent its fathers and sons on ships to Europe to die on the beaches there and in the fields, why a nation that has tried to establish early on in the colonial period and thereafter, to some degree, the rule of God on earth, a nation that has used the Bible even to learn to read through many of its generations, why a nation like that, unique in human history, powerful and able to influence the world, now finds itself an ally of a dictatorial, radical Islamic theocracy that supports Hamas rapist butchers. How is that possible? I mean, human history is always messy. I understand that. But how is it possible that America went from the America you're seeing in those D-Day clips, the America you've read about in the Declaration of Independence, how are we now what we are? AmericaUnderAttack.com. And that's all the time we have for the Week in Review here on Trumpet Hour. We'd love to get into a discussion on D-Day and on the America that was and is. But we'll have to do that another time. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate Parker Campbell and Isaac Lorenz there in production, week after week, faithfully serving. We appreciate our panelists, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. And we thank you for listening to The Week in Review. We look forward to being back with you next week here on Trumpet Hour.